the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. So that's something that Einstein said, and it's Einstein's very quotable. He says said lots of lovely things, and that's one of my favourite quotes of his. I wanted to start with that because it wasn't at the beginning of my talk. I'll reread it. Yes, the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. So in this talk, I want to, in a way, come back to that sense of wonder, that sense of awe. In a way, that's the basic thing that I want to talk about and try and evoke. I'm going to talk about it in, the talk's structured in three parts. I want to talk a little bit about what I mean by materialism and its limitations. I want to talk about Buddhism and materialism, the Dharma and materialism. And then I'm going to talk about two models that I find helpful, two sort of more integrated models of what's going on, of reality. But I wanted to start with a little story, a personal sort of story of being on retreat. I'm not quite sure when. It was one of my first retreats, so it was probably 94, 95, at Vrajaloka, just a few miles from here. It was my first intensive meditation retreat, and led by Tejananda, and I felt very, very, very happy, happier than I had ever been before. And I can remember walking in the pine forest above Vrajaloka. It was a beautiful sunny day, actually, for Wales. Well, for anywhere. The sun was quite low. The sun was sort of nearly setting. And I'd been trying to memorize the odes of Keats. I was trying to memorize them. I'm not quite sure for how long, but that was a little kind of project. And I was trying to recite to myself the Ode to the Nightingale, Ode to a Nightingale, and stumbling over some of the lines as I was walking along. And Keats's ode evokes, doesn't it, both beauty and impermanence, death and the joy of impermanence, the beauty of impermanence. And so that must have been somewhere in my mind. There are all these foxgloves amongst the pines. And what happened was that as I was walking past one of these foxgloves, these beautiful, tall flowers with little purple blossoms, one of the rays of the sun came through the pines. The sunlight just, you know, when it's low, it just came through. And it came through one of the blossoms. And it lit the flower up, completely lit the flower up. And it was just as I was passing. And for a moment, I was wrapped in awe. But it was more than that. It was more than that. It was more than just the wonder and the beauty. I suddenly knew what Keats was talking about. And for a moment, I think I glimpsed what the Dharma is talking about. The flower was made of light. Everything was made of light. The sunlight, which had travelled the millions of miles that it does across space and taken all those minutes to reach us. The sunlight had traveled through that blossom, that tiny blossom, and into my eye just as I was walking past. A sort of incredible coincidence of events over vast reaches of space and time. And suddenly, for a while, I knew that everything was connected and made of light in that same way, sort of frozen light. And I was so overwhelmed with joy. I think in Mitra study we'd been studying some Mahayana sutras, and I was always a bit perplexed by the sort of grandeur of the sutras, these vast visions of jewel trees and universes filled with billions of Buddhas and all of that. But for a moment, I knew that that was, in a way, a very, very appropriate way to describe life. It was completely appropriate, and that if I had language in a way that was an appropriate language to talk about this this wonder. So in a way, that was a very early glimpse that I found acted as a motivating glimpse for me to keep practicing. But I don't always, and very, in fact, seldom, glimpse the world as made of light. I think we become sort of heavy, don't we, and solid through our own self-forgetting. I think that's what we normally are. So when I talk about materialism, what I mean is scientific materialism. There are lots of different types of materialism, and I mean a particular view that sees the world as entirely explicable through matter, as if everything could be reduced and explained in terms of matter, matter alone. So there's no mind, there's no consciousness, in a way there's no spirit, no immaterial substance. And individuals who hold this belief see the universe as a huge device held together by pieces of matter functioning in subjugation to natural laws, complex laws, but nevertheless a huge device. And while we may not hold that view in that rigid, literal way, but some people do. And we may hold it in more subtle ways, and I want to explore that. But it's interesting, I was talking to a friend of mine recently who does hold that view. And we were having a lively debate. Actually, it got a bit too lively. I lost my cool at one point. We were having a lively debate. He's very good-natured, but wrong. He was saying that consciousness, the mind, is purely a byproduct of brain function. That the neurons firing in our brains can explain all experience that we have. Consciousness is just a brain function. So I said, okay, well, you can hold that, just as long as you're clear that Buddhism doesn't hold that view. And he said, no, Buddhism does. And I said, no, it doesn't. And he said, well, if the Buddha were alive today, he would hold that view. Because the brain, we know the brain, is a very, very, very complex organism. It's probably the most complex object in the known universe. If the Buddha could understand neuroscience and the complexities of the brain, he would agree with me. So at that point, I had to take a deep breath and say, no, he wouldn't agree with you. And I feel that you've misunderstood Buddhism, very, very deeply misunderstood Buddhism. And in a way, you might say, well, what's the problem? He could hold that view, and I can hold a more traditionally Dharmic view, and we can still both carry on with our Buddhist practice, And in a way, what's the problem? But I think there is a problem, because I think that our views matter. Our views really, really matter. They have a real effect on our experience. They have an effect on our behaviour. Different beliefs about the universe lead to different behaviour. What we believe must either be true or false. But before settling on the position you choose, you owe it to yourself to keep seeking the truth about life, death, and the universe. And that was C.S. Lewis speaking. One of the ways that I think views affect us is that they condition our experience. Maitre Bandhu's been talking about this recently, and he may talk about it in his workshop. He's been likening views that we hold like a net, like a drag net in our mind. And experience is filtered through that net. And depending on the shape of that net, we let certain experiences through. And if that net doesn't allow for those experiences, we just don't have them. We just don't have them. It's literally, we don't see the world if our views don't allow us to see the world in a certain way. In particular, our views condition our meditation experience. We must know this. Our views condition our meditation experience. And perhaps we don't know it deeply enough. Perhaps we don't know it deeply enough. From a traditional perspective, insight isn't going to arise without right understanding, without right view. And meditation, if we think that it's just a matter of technique, if we think it's just a matter of sitting in the right position, of getting in touch with our feelings in the right way, all of that might be very important. But without right view, we're not going to open up to the transcendental experiences that we're potentially capable of having. We need right view, we need Shraddha in order to meditate. Now, of course, Buddhism says that there's no such thing as absolute truth in terms of views. There's no completely right view. The Buddha talked in terms of right view and wrong view as more or less helpful. So some views are more helpful for the attainment of enlightenment, for the spiritual life, and some views are less helpful. No view is absolutely true. But nevertheless, right view is essential for the spiritual path. And I'm arguing that scientific materialism, to whatever degree we hold it, is a limiting and limited view. It's useful within a certain sphere of experience, but if we want to step outside of that experience, if we want to step into a deeper truth, then it's a limiting view, and it really will limit us. It'll limit us in meditation, it'll limit us in our behaviour, it'll limit us in all sorts of ways. And I'm going to explore a little bit more about how it might do that. But before I do that, I want to just say, well, I'm not anti-science. I'm not anti-science. I think that science, can be, and has been, has it not, of tremendous value to the world. A man called Ludwig von Mies said, "He who disdains the fall in infant mortality and the gradual disappearance of famines and plagues may cast the first stone upon the materialism of the economists." And yes, science and technology, its applications, has helped us enormously. Also, pure science as it's studied, as it's researched, can be a quest for truth. It's got something of nobility about it. It's got something of imagination about it. It's got something of courage and fearlessness about it. It's even got a sense of self-transcendence about it. I believe, in a way, Einstein exemplified what pure science at its best could look like embodied in a human being. That attitude of wonder, that attitude of self-transcendence, of service, of courage, he exemplified that. And other scientists do as well. My studying of physics came from wanting to, in a way, explore in that way a sense of wonder, and that the ultimate truth might be realizable through studying physics. As it was, I was disappointed. I spent most of my time trying to avoid lectures and studying physics at all. But when I did study physics, I found that the academic study of it didn't open me up to a sense of wonder. I had to let it go for many years before I could reconnect with that. What it did open me up to, though, was a sense that reason and common sense are not enough. Reason and common sense are not enough to get to the truth of things, even if you're a scientist and a materialist. Even if you're a materialist through and through, such as my friend is, reason and common sense are not enough to get to the truth of things. So that's something that I'll be exploring a little bit in the workshops when we look at quantum physics. Yeah, just for an example of that, you've probably heard of dark matter. Well, nobody knows what dark matter is. It's matter that we can't see because it's dark. Or it's dark because we can't see it, and it's out there. It might even be in here, because we wouldn't know. What we do now think, or know, is that 80% of all the matter in the universe is dark. So the entire observable universe that we think of is only 20% of all the matter in the universe. And we don't actually even understand that. When you look more deeply into what this 20% of matter is, it turns into something profoundly mysterious, something that you can't grasp, something that looks more like frozen light. And this dark matter, well, we haven't got a clue about. We haven't got a clue at all. But materialism has, I think, a more worrying limitation. And that is, of course, that materialism doesn't account for values. There's no room for values, whatever values you hold to. There's no explanation for that if we hold to a materialist universal view. So when we try to, in good faith, believe in materialism, in a sense, we don't even have an explanation for ourselves. We don't have an explanation for who we are. We certainly don't have an explanation for ethics. We don't have an explanation for love. We don't have an explanation for friendship. We don't have an explanation for why we might even strive for those things, for beauty, even in a sense, for the experience of truth. John Updike, the American writer, said that when we try in good faith to believe in materialism, in the exclusive reality of the physical, we are asking ourselves to step aside. We are disavowing the very realm where we exist and where all things precious are kept, the realm of emotion and conscience, of memory and intention and sensation. So without those things, without memory, without intention, without conscience, without emotion, without sensation, well, there's no life, let alone the spiritual life. There's no life possible. And I can understand why some people might hold this view in our modern culture. I think it's partly a reaction to God, isn't it? It's partly a reaction to Christianity. Partly it's a reaction to God, perhaps partly it's a response to the success of science in explaining so much. But I think that the culture that we live in is in, well, we all know, it's in crisis. Perhaps it's a crisis that's more urgent than even we realise, even as Buddhists we realise. It's in environmental crisis. It's in economic crisis. At least many of our countries in the Western world are in economic crisis. There's a sort of political, social crisis where on the one hand we have... well, we're trying to have a tolerant but secular society, at least in Britain. And then we've got religious fundamentalism on the other hand. And there's very little meeting point in between. We've got consumerism running rampant. And in a way, no real desire to stop that. The economic crisis that we're experiencing, the recession that we've just come out of in this country, well, the government's solution to that was to encourage us to go shopping, yeah, to shop our way out of recession. And that's the only solution that, well, now we're going to have lots of cutbacks, aren't we? So shopping and cutbacks are, in a way, the solution that we're being offered. On you've probably seen this if you're living in Britain, or at least in London, on some of the buses, there's this advert for a new cereal. It's not just a new brand of cereal. On the advert, it says it's a new breed of cereal, and it's called Crave. Crave with a K. I really like that. I was tickled by Crave, but I was also tickled by it was a new breed of cereal. I've not had any. But I'm not immune to the temptation myself. Recently, well, actually last year, I was in a bit of a dilemma. I've got some savings, and I wanted to spend some money on... a computer, a laptop. But I also wanted a painting of my Yidam, Manjigosha, and I wanted to ask Chintamani to paint me a painting. And I thought, well, I can't do both. What shall I do? And for some months I wrestled with, was it going to be a painting of my Yidam? Was it going to be a new laptop? And it took a few weeks or months, and then I, well, fortunately, finally decided I was going to ask Chintamani to paint me a painting. And I'm very, very glad that he did. It's very, very beautiful. And, well, just a little plug for Chintamani. If you're thinking of commissioning a painting of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva figure, he's available for commissions, and it was a delight to work with him, and it's tremendous, actually. I wish I had a copy of it here. So that was delivered in November, and I still feel my heart open when I sit in front of it to meditate. But about a month ago, I thought, well, what about that laptop? What about that laptop? Because you've got the painting. And so a couple of weeks ago, I was trying to write this talk on a laptop. I've got a laptop. I was trying to write it. I was writing about materialism, about craving, about this cereal. And I just thought, well, I'll have a look on the Apple website because they might have some good deals. And then I remembered that you can get second-hand machines and eBay. I'd never logged on to eBay. I'd managed to resist shopping on eBay. But I tried it. And it seemed really interesting because there were all these things on eBay. And then I put a bid in on eBay. And I don't know if you've ever done that. If you haven't done that, don't do that. Don't do it. Because as soon as you do, it says, "Congratulations, you are now the highest bidder." And then you're in tenterhooks, waiting for somebody to outbid you or not. And the clock ticks, and you get, you know, you get closer and closer to winning this thing. Anyway, I didn't win it. At least not at first. Because, of course, once you've put a bid in, you know, and you lose, well, you need to win, don't you? You need to do it again. So a few days ago, I've become the proud... Oh, no, well, I also was talking to Subhadramati, and in conversation, she mentioned she needed a new computer. So I thought, great, if I buy a new laptop, I can give her my old one, and then it's all right. Then it's all right. And I'm being dharmic and spiritual. So a few days ago, I've become the proud owner of a new Apple, well, a new-ish Apple MacBook. Anyway, you don't need to know more about that. Materialism coarsens and petrifies everything, making everything vulgar and every truth false. That's something that Henri Amiel, a Swiss writer, said. Actually, I've never read Henri Amiel. I'd never even heard of him. If you Google materialism, you can get all these lovely quotes. So anyway, it does have its uses, the laptop. I was thinking about the demon of materialism. The demon of materialism, if it exists, is faceless and limbless. I see it as a sort of black sludge, perhaps like the oil spill that's recently happened. A sort of black sludge that chokes life, that creeps up on you and doesn't look very threatening until you're choked, until all life is choked. So, moving on to the second part of my talk, I just want to emphasise how the Dharma, Buddhism, is not materialism. And also look at the dangers for us in the West, as practising Buddhists, of this view of materialism, of this black sludge. So the Buddha classified wrong views, didn't he, in terms of either they fall into believing in an eternal real substance or self, eternalism, or in nihilism, that there's nothing that survives death, that there's nothing beyond this physical body. And of course, materialism is of the second set of views. And it was emphatically rejected by the Buddha as a false doctrine. Interestingly, the Buddha said that nihilism was not just untrue, in the way that eternalism is also untrue, but that it was ugly. That nihilism was not just untrue, but it was ugly. And I think what I take from that is because it denies all values. At least if you believed in some eternal... Well, you might believe in a creator God, for example. Well, you can do a lot of damage in the world by believing in a creator God, but at least you're holding to some higher value. Yeah. Whereas nihilism, materialism, scientific materialism, in a certain sense, there's no room for any values. So yes, the Buddha said that materialism, nihilism, uchidavada, as it's called in Sanskrit, is not just wrong, but ugly. So yes, Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator God. It doesn't believe in an essential being that sits outside the universe and judges us and punishes us and rewards us and is particularly concerned about us on this seemingly insignificant planet, and us as a human race, and us particularly what we get up to when we don't have our clothes on. Buddhism doesn't believe in that sort of God. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't believe in something higher, something that transcends the known and the material. The Dharma is about a principle, a current, even a dynamic force in life, in the universe, that transcends matter, that transcends the individual life, but also that includes matter and the individual, that transcends space and time and yet operates within space and time, transcends all phenomena, but also is an active potential in all phenomena. So that's mysterious, and that current, that potential, that dynamic force is the source of all value and meaning. So Buddhism's not straightforward in that it's not simple, it's not simplistic, and it's not literal, and therefore it's difficult to talk about. When the Buddha was asked, are the mind and the body identical, or are they separate and different, he refused to answer. He refused to answer, because to say that they're identical would be wrong, to say that they're completely different would be wrong. Buddhism is more mysterious than that, and therefore it's more difficult to talk about. And, the Buddha, in a way, didn't speculate about metaphysics, did he? He didn't speculate, he just said, practice, practice, and you'll find out. But I think we live in a much more complex world where we're infected by views, and particularly by scientific materialism. All the, dangers of Buddhism that we face in the West come from, I think, this worldview of scientific materialism. Mostly in the West, as Western Buddhists, we're not going to fall prey to believing in a creator God. Yeah? But I think we will fall prey to, in a subtle way, believing in an essential matter. So what I would sort of say to my friend, what I ended up saying to my friend who was saying, yes, consciousness is just brain function, is I was saying, well, you don't know what matter is. You don't know what matter is at all. And if he'd studied physics, he'd agree with me. We don't know what matter is. We don't know what consciousness is. We don't know what mind is at all. So why try to reduce one to the other at all? Yeah? Wouldn't it be better to just say there's mystery and there's something going on, there is connectedness, there is conditioned arising, but we don't know what that means. We don't really know. So think about what you feel about rebirth. What are your views about whether something of us survives the death of the physical body or not? Bante said that you don't have to believe in rebirth in order to practice Buddhism. At the same time, he said that it's a very important part of Buddhism, and that all Buddhist teachers throughout the history of the tradition have said, have espoused the truth of rebirth. So what do we think about it? Woody Allen said, I don't believe in an afterlife, but I am bringing a change of underwear. And I like that. I like that. There's a certain sort of agnosticism, isn't there, to bringing a change of underwear, just in case. Just in case. As Buddhists, I think we can do a bit better than that. What I think, though, is that if, like my friend, you really think that there's nothing that survives the death of the physical body, then you have to acknowledge that that isn't what Buddhism says. You might be able to still practice meditation, you can practice ethics, but you've put a ceiling on your experience of the Dharma, because that's not what Buddhism says. So I just want to look next at how materialism, how scientific materialism infects Buddhism, how this black sludge creeps up on us unawares. And, the first point, the first way that I think it can creep up on us, and I think this is a real danger, is that we can start to see Buddhism purely in therapeutic terms. We can start to relate to meditation, even to ethics, even to Buddhist ideas, as if it was all about just making my life a bit happier, your life a bit happier, making samsara more comfortable, That's what I mean by therapeutic terms. I'm not having a go at therapy. What I'm saying is that that is a limiting view, that the Dharma is not about making samsara more comfortable. Hopefully we do become happier, but that can't be an end in itself. That can't be what life is about. Einstein again. Everybody has certain ideals which determine the direction of their endeavours and their judgments. In this sense, I have never looked upon ease and happiness as ends in themselves. Such an ethical basis I call more proper for a herd of swine. That's strong, isn't it? Such an ethical basis I call more proper for a herd of swine. Because after all life wants to be happy in a certain sense. All animal life, maybe even plant life, wants to be happy. The human condition offers us more than that. And the Dharma asks more of us than that. So yes, let's not reduce the Dharma to a therapy, even though there are very many valuable therapeutic tools to be found in the Dharma. Bhante was saying, apparently when he visited Butterfield, he met with Christopher Titmus at Butterfield Festival, and he said that Christopher Titmus said that the main danger, the most significant danger for Buddhism in the West was that it would be reduced to a therapy. I don't know how Christopher Titmus put it, but that's what Bhante said, he said. So I find that salutary. And if we do that, there's no possibility of transcendence. We've immediately put a cap on our experience. We won't have deeper experiences if we limit our views, or at least we're more less likely to have deeper experiences. And the trouble is that using our reason, using our sort of scientific reason, is very seductive, and we think we can explain life in those terms. As a consequence, we won't have deeper experiences, and until you have a deeper experience, you don't realise the limitation of your view. So there's a sort of vicious circle, a catch-22, which we need to break out of. But I think it's worse than that. Not only can Buddhism be reduced to, in a way, therapeutic terms, but there's then a sort of narcissistic attitude that we can get into, a sort of a selfishness at worst, a benign humanism at best, that we reduce our spiritual lives to. In a certain sense, if our lives are all about us, just us, becoming happier, and that's why we meditate, and that's all we do, or that's why we try and practice the Dharma, and that's all we're doing, there's a certain refined selfishness to that, I think. There has to be at least some degree of altruism in our practice. But even that's not enough, because without a view that transcends conditioned existence, even our altruism, as I say, can be no more than a benign humanism. Good though that is, it's not enough. Another way that I believe that, in a way, Buddhism is infected by materialist thinking is our fear of hierarchy. Because I think what happens is we reduce everything to the known. We reduce all values to values that we can know, and then we're suspicious of any sort of hierarchy. We're suspicious of anybody that might embody higher values to a greater extent than we embody them. Yeah, and this is a very, very common danger in Western Buddhism. It's even a danger in our movement. It's as if there's nothing to learn. There's no one to learn from, and no ideals to strive for. Now, that's putting it perhaps too bluntly and crudely. I'm trying to do so to make a point. Buddhism, when it's infected by materialism, can become a lot more subtle than that. it can become a lot more subtle. It can say, for example, that all you have to do is be aware now of current experience, and that's enough. Yeah? It's all here now in current experience. And what that can easily mean is that a profound truth is reduced to an everyday commonplace so that I don't have to get out of bed in the morning. Because actually I'm happy in my bed in the morning. I'm happy a lot of the time, as Sadhanandi said, but in my bed in the morning is a peak time a lot of the time. So if I don't have to... too much information, says Sadhanandi. So an anti-hierarchical view of the Dharma. An ethical relativism. So it's all right for me to hold those views. You can hold some other views live your life according to whatever views you hold. I was talking to an order member recently who was saying, well, he really, really values what he's been given. He's a new order member. Really, really values what he's been given in our Sangha by Bhante, by the Dharma. But he doesn't want to impose that on anybody else. So he's reluctant to teach. Because isn't he not imposing a value system on anybody else? And what a shame. What a shame. That's ethical relativism creeping into the Dharma when he could be doing a lot of good in the world. Actually, he is teaching, and that's fine. I also think there's a subtle emotional hardening of the heart that happens if we hold some of these views. There's a subtle cynicism that happens if we think that matter is all there is, that the body is all there is, that life is just about becoming as comfortable as we can be. And that too can be rationalized, as I say, into the spiritual life. It's irrational to be wedded to materialism. It's irrational to be wedded to reason, but we manage to rationalize it. So there's some of the ways I could go on, and I'm not going to anymore, about how materialism can infect the Dharma, particularly, I think, the Dharma in the West. What I now want to do is just look at two models, one from the Buddhist tradition and one not, that I think have a more positive, integrated way of looking at reality. So the first of these comes from a man called Ken Wilber, who I think has some very, very interesting things to say. He's an American philosopher, thinker, sort of synthesizer. And he says, well, you can look at life, you can look at any phenomena in four different ways. And I'm going to draw something on the flip chart. If you can't see it where you're sitting, we'll have a look at it later. I'm going to talk us through as I draw it, so it won't actually... hopefully it'll become clear even if you can't see it. So what I'm going to draw is a... You have to take this page as meaning all phenomena, yeah? All phenomena, this blank page. Everything that's happening is this page. And I'm going to draw a line, a vertical line, right down the middle of the page. Right down the middle of the page. So we've immediately split all phenomena into the left-hand side and the right-hand side. We've split phenomena into two. And the left-hand side is internal phenomena, subjective phenomena. It's the experience of consciousness of our minds. It's our inner experience. And the right-hand side is all outer phenomena, all so-called objective phenomena. It's the external world. If you like, it's the world of matter as opposed to world of mind. But then Wilber goes further. What he does is he splits this further. He draws another line, and this time it's a horizontal line. So I've now got four quadrants. All phenomena now are in one of four quadrants. Actually, they're in all four quadrants. And what he does is this split is of individual and collective. So now you have four quadrants, And he says that any phenomena that happens can be viewed from the perspective of any of these quadrants. So you've got the internal individual, so what's happening in my mind. You've got the individual objective, what's happening in one atom out there. You've got a collective internal and a collective external, or collective objective. So if I just give an example, so I have the thought, I should be free to think for myself. I should be free to think for myself. It's a common thought, isn't it? I have that thought. There's an inner experience of that thought, which only I can experience when I'm having it. Yeah? There's an inner experience of thinking. It can have a sort of physical manifestation, but it's inward. And that would be this quadrant. But if I was strapped up to a machine with electrodes on my head, measuring the neurons firing in my brain, as I have that thought, I should be free to think of myself, there would be electrical signals that you could measure in the brain. And that would be this quadrant, this outer objective correlate to the thought. Yeah? But then you take this thought, I should be free to think for myself, and that comes from a particular culture. Yeah, it comes in a particular language. In the Western world, you've got Romanticism, you've got Keats having these thoughts. We're inheritors of a whole culture before we can even have the thought, I can think for myself. And that's this quadrant, the internal collective, the subjective collective quadrant. And then, out of that culture, out of many people having that thought, we build society. So in this country, we've just voted in an election, in a general election. Who knows what we've done? But we've done something. And that democratic structure has come from this thought. Yeah? It's come from this thought. And so we've built a society that in part comes from this thought, and that's this quadrant, this collective but objective society. What I find interesting is that Wilber says any phenomena can be viewed from those four dimensions. So you can't reduce anything just to one quadrant. You can't say it's all matter up here. You can't say it's all mind in here. You can't say it's all individual in here. You can't say it's all collective, it's all to do with society. All of those perspectives have some value. They have some relevance. They have some truth. What I also find interesting is that Wilber says, so if you take something external, this lectern, it too has an inner dimension. It too has an inner dimension. In a certain sense, everything is alive. Everything is alive. And I find this interesting because this is the Dharmic perspective. We don't live in a dead universe. From a Dharmic perspective, we live in a universe that's alive. Everything, in some sense, has an inner dimension to it, a sort of vitality to it. Bhante, in his seminar on the nature of existence, from his book The Three Jewels, talks about this at one point. And he says that, yes, as Buddhists, we should be striving to see everything as alive. There's no such thing as inanimate matter. And then he says this might be more difficult to do with certain types of matter. And he says that he himself finds it difficult to think of plastic as alive. And then he says, but that's his limitation, and he hopes to overcome it someday. So even plastic is alive in some sense. So this is a brief look at Wilber's model in these four quadrants. So a more Buddhist perspective of looking at this sort of area is the model of the five niyamas. And I'm just going to touch on this model, and we might look at it more in the workshop that I'm going to do. In this model, as you know, the central teaching, the central view of Buddhism, the central truth of Buddhism can be summarized as conditioned co-production, as all things arising in dependence upon conditions and then ceasing when those conditions are taken away. And the model of the five niyamas talks about different types of conditionality, different types of conditioned arising. Niyama meaning order or law or a type of conditioning. And Buddhism talks of five types of niyamas. This comes from commentaries on the Pali Canon. So it's fairly early, but it's after the time of the Buddha. And the first type of niyama, the first type of order, is to do with inanimate or inorganic matter. It's the laws of physics, the laws that govern inorganic matter. The law of gravitation, the law of electromagnetism, would all be covered by this first type of niyama, the uttu niyama. Yeah? But Buddhism says, according to this model, when inorganic matter collects into certain complex arrangements, something else emerges. What emerges is life. And this is the bija niyama. And life has its own laws of conditionality. Plants grow according to certain conditioned arisings, a certain order. The bija niyama is the niyama that governs life, that governs plant life and animal life, biology, chemistry, biochemistry. Then there's the third niyama. So when life becomes complex enough, when it becomes integrated enough, something else emerges. And what emerges is mind or rudimentary consciousness, instinctive consciousness. Animals have this. Animals have very, very complex instincts. Bees are able to dance, aren't they, and navigate their ways to foxgloves. Actually, I don't know a thing about bees, but that's probably what they do. That's the manoniyama, this instinctive mind that we have, animal life has. But then Buddhism has two more niyamas. And the first of these arises when mind becomes complex enough to have a sense of self. When a sense of self arises, when I have self-consciousness, the karma niyama comes into play. The karma niyama starts to operate as a natural law. Ethical life, ethical values have effect. They are a law of the universe, just like the law of gravitation, and they come into effect when we have self-consciousness, and that is the karma niyama. But then there's something else. There's the Dharma Niyama. The Dharma Niyama is what transcends the individual. It transcends the self. It actually transcends all the other niyamas. It is the transcendent urge, if you like. You could say it is the evolutionary urge that has caused, as it were, conditioned all of this arising. It's the urge in us towards the three jewels, towards the ideal. It's the urge in us to transcend ourselves. According to this model, the Dharma Niyama, as it were, is none of these quadrants. It's the blank page. It's the blank page that this diagram is drawn on. But you mustn't think of it as a ground of reality. It's a dynamic urge in the universe that's operating everywhere, all the time, in us as we try and go for refuge. Okay, so I'm going to start to conclude now. So that's a very, very brief glimpse of two models, the five niyamas and Wilber's four quadrants, an inadequate glimpse of both of those. Just to summarise then, what I'm saying is that our views matter. Our views really, really matter. And it's important that we become conscious of the views that we hold. At least this friend that I was having this argument, this debate with, at least he was conscious of the views that he held. Sometimes some of us aren't very conscious of what we believe, not at a deeper level. So our views matter. Let's try and become conscious of what our views are. Science has great value, but it also has limitations, particularly scientism scientific materialism as a philosophy of life is dangerous. It's not compatible with the Dharma. It limits the Dharma. It infects the Dharma. It's dangerous. It's a demon. And then we looked briefly at two more integrated ways of looking at, well, what's going on. So mainly what I want to come back to and in conclusion is this sense of wonder. Because I think if we can stay in touch with a sense of wonder, perhaps I should say Shraddha. Because Shraddha has wonder as part of it. If we can stay in touch with Shraddha, then in a way those limitations, well, at least they start to open up. They start to open up. If the stars could appear, if the stars should appear, but one night every 1,000 years, how we would marvel and stare. That's Emerson. If the stars should appear, but one night every 1,000 years, how we would marvel and stare. We forget to marvel and stare. So yes, trying to stay in touch with a sense that everything is alive, that we don't know what's going on. We haven't got the first clue. We have really not got the first clue. Looking at our views, let's look at what views we do hold. And even if we hold views that aren't in accordance with the Dharma, even if we can't believe in rebirth, well, see if we can hold our views more lightly. Yeah? We don't really know what's going on, so why be so fixed? See if we can, pack a change of underwear all the time. If we can do that, then again, the Dharma Niyama can break through, can start to shine through. So those foxgloves, I just want to return to that foxglove. For me, for a moment, there was a tiny, tiny tear in the veil of delusion. It was a glimpse of something. And even that glimpse of a glimpse of something was ecstatic. And I think that our task is to trust those glimpses. We all have glimpses of something. And we need to trust them. Not only do we need to trust them, we need to try and orientate more and more of our life so that we live by those glimpses. And we have to do that all the time. We have to keep choosing that sense of wonder over the known. And that requires courage. That requires letting go of our sense of security, of the known. It requires us trusting in universal values and prioritizing those over personal desires. There's safety in laptops and mortgages and cereals called Crave. Practicing the Dharma isn't safe. It'll never be safe. It's dangerous. So let's use our reason. I don't mean to be anti-reason in this talk. Let's use our reason, but let's not be limited by it. Let's not be limited by anything. Let's, in a way, if we could stay in touch with wonder, then the weapons of this demon of materialism would turn into flowers. They'd turn into foxgloves. They'd turn into flowers of wonder as they approached us. And to do that, we have to develop a new kind of mind. A new kind of mind. When Copernicus first said that the sun wasn't going round the earth, but the earth was going round the sun, it sparked a revolution. It sparked a revolution in the Western world. It was the Copernican revolution. People didn't know what their place in the universe was. If the earth could go around the sun, what did that mean? What did it mean for God? What did it mean for who created the earth and the sun? It completely turned everything upside down. We need such a revolution of consciousness in our minds. I think that the universe revolves around me a lot of the time. I mean, I think that a lot of the time. It revolves around me. Yeah. I need a Copernican revolution of consciousness that actually sees the way things really are. If we could do that, if I could develop this new mind that was refined enough, positive enough, integrated enough, pliable enough, pure enough to feel the touch of the Dharma Niyama, then I feel that I would be living a truly human life. Nothing is more important than this. This is what life is about. This is what we have evolved for. This is what we've evolved for, not the Apple MacBook. This is what we've evolved for, and if we forget that, particularly if we forget that as Western Buddhists, there's a tragedy in our lives. If we'd never come across the Dharma at all, perhaps it would be not so tragic. It would be sad, but not so tragic. Having come across the Dharma, let's not forget it. Let's not forget it. I want to finish with Einstein again. Well, I'll just let his words speak. It was the experience of mystery that engendered religion. A knowledge of the existence of something we cannot penetrate, of the manifestations of the profoundest reason and the most radiant beauty, which are only accessible to our reason in the most elementary forms. It is this knowledge and this emotion that constitute the truly religious attitude. In this sense, and in this sense alone, I am a deeply religious man. Thank you.